Welcome to this Monday edition of Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and I hope you had a fantastic Thanksgiving holiday. Today's show has plenty to offer as we navigate this holiday season together. Later, clinical psychologist Dr. Helen McKibben joins us to introduce a groundbreaking technique for managing emotional triggers, relieving stress, and making mindful choices around holiday eating. But first, we'll hear from Shannon Watson. Her work focuses on fostering civility and bridging divides to reduce partisanship in today's polarized landscape. She'll be speaking Wednesday at Concordia College. Shannon, welcome to Main Street.
Good to see you, Craig. How's it going?
It's going very well. I hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving.
I did. Very low key, which is perfect for me.
Shannon, you are founder of Majority in the Middle. And before we really begin our discussion on why you're coming to Concordia College on Wednesday, tell me, what is Majority in the Middle?
So Majority in the Middle is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We do a lot of education and advocacy around bringing the middle back to politics. And it's interesting. Sometimes people ask us, you know, well, what do we mean by the middle? Because I don't know if I, you know, fit into your definition. It sort of segmented itself into three. So some people in the middle are ones that are, you know, they see themselves as like a Democrat or a Republican, but they think of themselves as moderate. So that's one way of being in the middle. One way of being in the middle is people who don't really identify with one party because they hold some views on the right and some views on the left. And so they think of themselves as in the middle. And then there are people, and this was the most surprising to me, who are sort of hardcore left or right, hardcore Democrat, hardcore Republican, but they believe in the idea that once people are elected and their job is to govern, that their job is to find collaboration and compromise and sort of a win-win situation. And so they have come to be part of the group as well. And I think that is fabulous because we talk a lot about, you know, not compromising your values, but still working towards the common good.
It seems to me that it's almost today, like you can't talk to the other side, regardless of what it is that you agree upon. You can't talk to the other side, or I will chastise you. I will ridicule you. I will tell everyone how evil you are. We've heard this from both sides. Is the tide changing, or is that what you're hopeful about?
I think there are some people who are deliberately trying to cross the aisle. Now, there's an organization called Braver Angels out there, and they teach people how to talk. It was founded in part by a marriage and family therapy professor who teaches people how to talk across difference and how to, you know, sort of work through these conflict situations. We've found, and I absolutely recommend that if anybody wants to learn, look them up. They're great. I have found that our sort of spheres of influence, spheres of socialization, most of us have gotten into the points where, you know, we don't have anybody of the other side in our friend group or in the family that we talk to. And so that becomes a little more difficult when you actually have to kind of seek out someone to talk about things with. And then if you don't have the basis for that relationship, that makes the other sort of disagreements okay, it's really hard. It stays on that surface level, and it's more about the conflict than about the discussion or the, you know, the interaction, the understanding.
I was good friends with Senator Mike Enzi from Wyoming. He was a three-term senator. He had the Enzi rule, which was all of us pretty much agree on 80% of everything.
Yes.
So let's work on that 80%, get something done, and then we'll try to deal with the 20% later. And he passed over 100 bills on his own. Very popular in Wyoming, but wouldn't be elected in Wyoming today.
Yeah.
Because of the polarization that exists for sure. Why is that? Why are folks who really are trying sometimes can't be even successful to be heard?
Yeah, because they're punished for it. So the the impetus for majority in the middle came to me from a couple of places. The first one was I have been watching sort of the middle drop out of political engagement for a long time, and it's been worrying me. And about 4 years ago, I got to the point where I was just like, no, we have hit a tipping point, and we need people who support working across the aisle and who support concentrating on that 80%. We need those people to participate in caucuses. We need those people to vote in primaries. We need those people to run for office, because if the sort of first building blocks of a campaign are those really ultra partisan grassroots groups, and I'm not trying to defame them or anything, but those groups where you have the caucuses, where you have the individual party units, those are generally the people who are the most sort of stringent about their ideas and their beliefs. And they are super involved in participating in who gets elected and what candidates make it to the ballot in November. I mean, you know, most campaigns, like, the November isn't the finish line. The filing in July or August or June isn't the finish line. It's the party caucuses, which happen in, you know, November or January or February. And if you don't get involved there, or if you get sort of knocked out of the process, you don't make it all the way to when, quote unquote, everybody votes in November. So there's a couple of pieces to that. Is first, getting people who would support those candidates, getting them involved in those early stages, but then also having the candidates who believe in that 80%, having them run and having them not stop after the endorsement. Endorsements only work if people abide by them. I mean, I tell a lot of people, like, just go to the primary. Like, you know, if you want to go for the endorsement, great, but go to the primary, because otherwise you are allowing 200 people out of a district of 80,000 to decide who winds up in the ballot in November.
Enjoying our conversation with Shannon Watson. She is founder of Majority in the Middle and is speaking Wednesday at Concordia College. It's a free luncheon, and you are certainly all invited. Shannon, how would you describe what you saw in this last election?
Oh, okay. I love this question, because I assume that you are talking about the presidential election. Is that correct?
I left it open.
Okay, cool. Yes. And that's the thing. Since Election Day over the past month, a lot of people have been talking about the election. And during campaign season, we've been talking about the election. I actually spend very little time looking at presidential politics, because it seems to me to be the thing I can do the least about. Like, this is the race I can least control. I can tell, we do most of our work in Minnesota, so I can tell you that on November 5th in Minnesota, there were 4,672 electoral races in Minnesota. 4,672 people got elected in Minnesota on November 5th. Donald Trump was one of them. And so the focus on just the presidential race, I think, takes a lot away, because most people who are heavily involved in politics will tell you that the effect on your everyday life is probably the closest government to you. So that's your city council, your township, your county commission. Those are people who are really actually going to affect your daily life, the property taxes you pay, how your trash gets picked up, whether the water coming out of the faucet is clean or not. And instead, we get distracted by the national thing. So I would say I'm encouraged that 4,672 people stood up for election. I'm also a little nervous about, there were 33 school board races in Minnesota that nobody won because there were no candidates for those races. So that's the thing. I think we get really worked up about things on the national level, and we don't pay enough attention to the local. So
what's your mission, one of the questions, Shannon, with Majority in the Middle? What do you do to empower individuals to be thoughtful collaborators, I guess?
Awesome. We have sort of three focuses. The first one is on being a space for people who consider themselves to be in the middle, again, whatever that means to them. And so we host events, we share information, Because sometimes the middle is a really lonely place to be. And sometimes people just need to understand it's not just you who doesn't completely feel comfortable on very far this side or very far that side. We try to enable the and amplify the behavior we like to see. We do a lot of work with elected officials in Minnesota, both at the local level and the state level.
What type of work?
So we have a thing that we do called the State of Bipartisanship Report. And that is an analysis of the bills that we're getting hearings over the last 2 years in the Minnesota legislature. And the thing that we found most interesting out of this report that we didn't know we were going to find when we started doing it, it sort of started for a different reason, and then it became this thing, was that, you know, when we get to the end of the legislative session and you have omnibus bills that are, you know, it's like, oh, everything passes on a party line vote and we know what's going to happen. Yes, if there's ever a hill I'm going to die on, it's omnibus bills. But so when you get to the end of session and then it's, well, these bills passed on party line votes and it's the majority who has their whole agenda getting enacted. But actually, if you look back at the individual bills that, again, go into make up those omnibus bills, but there's a lot more bipartisanship involved in the crafting of those bills. If you look at the total authorship of who's on a bill, there's a lot of purple in the middle. And we find it's really helpful to let other, you know, let legislators who are sort of crossing the aisle know, like, you got a lot of friends doing this work as well. It feels lonely, because that's the thing. Legislators in particular and everyday people also, when you're trying to work across a political aisle, more often than not, the opposition is going to come from your own side of the aisle, not the other side of the aisle. Your friends are the meanest to you.
That's a surprising statement to me.
Right. And, you know, it was surprising to me as well. When I first put Majority in the Middle together, I was like, okay, we got to fix this. I don't know how we're going to fix it. And so I went to the brain trust. I talked to a lot of current, former legislators. And I said, okay, you know, I've been in and around the Capitol for a long time. I've been a lobbyist. I've been in public affairs. I was a staff person, you know, but I've never held that election certificate. What's your experience? What do you see as an opportunity to change things? And I heard over and over that the opposition to working across the aisle comes from within your own caucus and from your leadership. And so just trying to let people know that, you know, you're not alone when you're trying to work across the aisle. And then the other piece is elected officials have to exist in an attention economy. We have an attention economy right now. And particularly when people are running for office and when they are trying to you know, get their story told, it is helpful to be sort of rewarded for doing the stuff that we want to see, working across the aisle. And so we try to, point media towards those stories, like, hey, here's this thing that's happening, and these two people are working on it. I will say that has been a little easier the last couple of years, because people working across the aisle on legislation is unusual, so it's news. So that's been a little easier to tell that story. It's not just like, oh, well, that's boring, that's every day, because it isn't. So we do that, and then we also try to remind constituents that if this is what you expect of your elected officials, and most people think that, like, well, duh, of course we want people to work together. And of course we want people to, you know, find common ground and agreement. Those are not the people that legislators are hearing from. So if that is something that you care about, if you care about collaboration and cooperation and all the things, then you have to let your elected officials know. Because the only people that they're generally hearing from are advocates and lobbyists, who, you know, they play a role and they do have a piece of the puzzle. But if legislators don't hear from their constituents that this is what constituents want, it's not top of mind.
How would you visit with someone who's a skeptic who might be thinking, I'd love to be one of those 4,000 in Minnesota, probably half that, or I don't know the number in North Dakota, but certainly over 1,000 probably people stood for election in our state in one way or another, but I can't make a difference. I'm not part of that group that is well ingrained and knows everything, but I want to try. What would you tell that person?
Oh, I would remind them that everybody who, you know, stands up to serve their community does so with the same sort of life experience that they bring to the table and sort of the same baggage that they bring to the table. I used to work with a lot of first-time candidates. I will tell you, like, I worked in electoral politics for like 20 years.
And I'll just add here, everybody had their first time running, right?
Absolutely. Yes. Something like 92 or 98% of first-time candidates usually lose. And pretty much 50% of candidates always lose, because if you have two people in a race and one person loses and one person wins, like 50% of candidates, but like something like 92 or 98% of first-time candidates lose. And so the really good way to approach a first race, beyond just saying this is my first time trying, is to do it as an educational sort of thing. I mean, obviously don't run if you're not ready to serve, but at the same time, just going through that process once can be helpful. And don't necessarily assume that, you know, your skeletons in the closet or your baggage or whatever is disqualifying. We need people who are in public service who have, you know, messed up with credit cards. I mean, how many of us haven't messed up with credit cards, or have experienced homelessness, or have a divorce, or had, you know, lost a job because they lost their childcare and then they couldn't get to work? You know, these kind of things are what we need people with lived experience to help crafting that public policy, whether that's at the local level or the state level or the national level. So that's, you know, just try, assume that your first time is going to be about the education, not necessarily about the win. And then if you do win, then great, you're ahead of the game.
Shannon Watson is speaking on Wednesday at Concordia College. She is the founder of Majority in the Middle. It's a free luncheon. Shannon, what's your message going to be?
Oh, goodness. So the question that was posed to me was, how do we create a more trustworthy world, which is sort of the focus of the center. And I love this question because it gets to a really human element that I think sometimes we overlook when we're talking about politics and public policy. We get caught up in the business of it and the game of it. And it really does come down to what each of us can do as individuals, how we can approach our interactions with other people. And most of that starts up in our own head. So we're going to talk about some tips and tricks to sort of frame your own thinking around other people. And that's the teaser I'll give.
Speaking of framing your thinking around other folks, what advice do you give to people who are already in that leadership role to foster that culture of trust and unity in their local area, rather than that worrisome, divisive posture?
Yes. So I get the benefit of speaking to a group of elected officials next week as well. So I've been sort of thinking about these two questions simultaneously. And I will say, one of the reasons that my organization focuses a lot on elected officials is that affected officials are leaders in this, whether they want to be or not. This just kind of comes with the hat of being elected. And so I would say there are primarily two things. The first one is staying in your lane. Is if your job is on the school board, then keeping your focus on the jurisdiction of the school board and what the school board is supposed to do, and not getting distracted by other issues. And then the second one is sort of over-communicating how you think about issues and how you have thought about sort of the opposition talking points, or the, you know, the reasons that you don't support something. Over-communicating is a good thing, particularly when you're talking about why you're making decisions, how you came to thinking about things, because sometimes just the acknowledgement that somebody has thought through an issue, like, you know, you go to a city council meeting and there's the public hearing part and people get up and they talk about, you know, whatever it is they want to talk about. And then if, like, let's say the city council doesn't do what they want to do, they're like, well, I'm not being heard. not being heard and not being agreed with are two separate things. And so, like, if you are a city council member up on the dais and you can say, you know, I'm voting this way because this, you know, this good thing, this good thing, this good thing. And I've also considered this, you know, thing that is negative or whatever, this thing, and this thing, because it reminds people that they have been heard. You might not agree with them, but you've at least listened, and you can approach their issue with knowledge and information.
We have about a minute left, Shannon. Do you have examples that you can share with us about successful collaboration that you've witnessed, dialogue between individuals or groups that started really opposed, but then came together?
Yeah. You know, one of my favorites this year, or 2023 in the Minnesota legislature, there was a bill that was banning conversion therapy. And there was significant support for this bill, but there was also concern about how that affected speech of clergy and, you know, therapists who have a license, and adults who really wanted to engage in this conversation sort of on their own behalf. And so the lead author of the bill, who's a Democrat, and worked very closely with another member of the Republican caucus to craft a bill with some carve-outs that did exactly what they both wanted to do. They both wanted it to protect kids and then take all the other considerations into account. And I think that it wasn't easy. It came with a lot of hard conversations and a lot of like uncomfortableness. But those two in particular, they worked through the uncomfortable in a way that was really like this is public service at its best, is working through these things. And they came up with a bill that, that had pretty decent bipartisan support and did what they wanted it to do, that they could agree on. And I give them huge props for that.
Shannon Watson, you can hear her speak on Wednesday at the Lorenzen Center for Faith and Work at Concordia College. They're hosting a free luncheon that will feature Shannon. She is the founder of Majority in the Middle, and she has been my guest on Main Street. Shannon, thank you so much and best wishes.
Craig, thank you so much. I really appreciate the invitation.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the FM Area Foundation, offering the Caring Catalog, December 2nd through the 13th. An online giving platform connecting community members with local nonprofits during the holiday season. Learn more at areafoundation.org. FM Area Foundation, connecting people and purpose.
Coming up after the break, clinical psychologist Dr. Helen McKibben reveals a revolutionary technique to help you overcome emotional triggers, relieve stress, and finally make peace with that second plate of holiday cookies. Stick around. It's advice your waistband will thank you for. That's after this. Welcome back to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. My guest, clinical psychologist, Dr. Helen McKibben. Dr. McKibben, welcome back to Main Street.
Well, thank you for having me.
You are author of Drop Making Great Decisions, which introduces a groundbreaking technique for overcoming emotional triggers, relieving stress, and making better life choices. And Dr. McKibben, I think that I should have had you on maybe before Thanksgiving to help me with all of the food that was running around our house and the holiday treats that we made and did all those other things. But we can talk about holiday food challenges, I think, as we begin our conversation today. Tell me, Dr. McKibben, how do the holidays exacerbate, I guess, emotional eating patterns? And why do so many of us, me included, feel so out of control with our food choices during the holidays?
Well, Craig, there's four components that the brain integrates when we make food choices. And one of them has to do with childhood preferences and memories. And those are exacerbated when we're home. But my whole life's work is being sure that each of your listeners has a way, even if it's the holidays and a lot of memories are getting triggered from foods in the past, that they have a healthy way of making food choices.
Okay, so we went around the room and we said, what is your favorite holiday treat? And my grandkids weighed in, my wife weighed in, my children weighed in. And of course, we're obviously looking forward to that. And then we made half of them afterwards and enjoyed it. Is this a seasonal food addiction? Is that a real thing? Is that more about habits and triggers like you talked about?
Well, habit is a wonderful word. We make food choices based on habits, but it's more than just one day, or it's more than making a food choice and not making decisions afterwards. That's incredibly important. So here we go. When the brain makes food choices, it has four systems that it draws from. The first one is if the individual at your Thanksgiving or holiday meal is low on calcium or low on liquids, the brain will have that individual automatically and unconsciously crave a drink. Aunt Susie, can I have a drink of water? No, we're going to eat. Well, give them the drink of water, because the first thing that happens in our brains is our brain makes us crave things that we're nutritionally low on, or if the brain's liquid levels are not met, it's going to have that individual crave, you know, a glass of water or a glass of milk if they're low on calcium. The second thing the brain integrates is childhood preferences. Well, we're at home, right? We're having a holiday meal. We've got our nieces and nephews and grandchildren, but their preferences are set based on childhood memories. If, when they were young, they came downstairs and they saw there was eggs on the table and they had a memory of, oh, I didn't like the white stuff that was in the scrambled eggs, the child, if they're listening to themselves, will say, well, my preference is I want cereal. I don't want those eggs again because I didn't like the way I ended up feeling. The other thing that is involved in your holiday meal is, well, they tried the sweet potatoes, but mom's were better, so they decided not to eat that, because preferences are also made on what we enjoyed growing up, what we liked about our family system, and new foods are difficult to integrate for anyone. The other thing, the fourth and final integration, is the here and now for the individual. Is out Nancy on a diet? Is she trying to eat only protein, not calcium or carbohydrates? So each of those four systems, the brain's messages that sends us cravings, our childhood preferences, memory retrieval of eating too much or not eating too much of that particular food or that holiday meal, as well as the here and now decisions the person is making about their body or has to make if they're diabetic or if they're on a particular food prescription plan. All four of those go into making food choices. If the individual ignores the cravings the brain is putting together automatically for us from those four categories, we get in trouble. We walk away from the holiday meal and we feel ill, or we ate something we weren't supposed to, and we re-decide using those memories, even with big holidays, of what to do differently next time we get together in that family setting.
We purposefully use tradition around Thanksgiving, Dr. McKibben. We remember how mom used to do it. We use her recipes, our daughter, our son, my wife. I mean, we literally used my mom's recipes to make a lot of the things that we had. And that's a good feeling for us. But how are you suggesting that we recognize and then separate those emotions from our actual needs? It seems to me, so tightly intertwined.
They are. What a wonderful statement. Emotions are feelings and feelings are memories. So, yes, we recreate the recipe that we loved and everyone enjoys it. But the other thing that comes into play is the individual's particular plan they are for eating, or the memory of the last time they ate that much turkey, did they get sick or not? So the brain is constantly bringing up feeling memories of what happened before to make our decisions about what we're eating in the here and now, even if it's a favorite food, even if that food meets the cravings that we're having.
What do we do then for the rest of the time from now until Christmas? We're all going to be walking by the great treats that our office workers made at the holiday party where the food is just wonderful. We don't likely need much of any of it, yet it'll be there staring at us, almost saying, I taste so good. I taste so good. What should we do?
Wonderful question. Here is my response, and my response to all of you listeners is a method. If after you walk away from a situation and you are triggered by a food, you know, office treats, thinking about Christmas, what you'll eat or not eat, when you get triggered, the brain quickly puts together what your preferences were, what worked for you, what didn't work for you. And if you sit back with yourself long enough, the brain will redecide what to do differently at Christmas. Or it will redecide based on looking at those treats in the office that we really don't need. But our brain won't make a decision based on what someone else says or a book says. It will remember the last time we ate those treats during the holiday season or prior or even afterwards, and use the way we ended up feeling physically and emotionally to make a decision about indulging that in that or not.
So what's the first thing we should do when we feel that overwhelming urge to indulge in all of those great treats that are going to be with us then? What's the first thing we should do if we are concerned about our overall health and the longer term impact that the holiday overeating can have on us?
The first cue that you want to pause long enough to listen to yourself before you reach for and made a food choice is that our brain lights us up physically. Increased heart rate, the smile on our face, holding breath, holding muscles, rolling our eyes. The physical cue indicates that the brain is putting together a memory recall, a feeling recall, that we need to sit back through long enough to listen to what our brain puts together and our choices before we ingest that food.
We're enjoying our conversation with clinical psychologist Dr. Helen McKibben. She's the author of the book Drop, Making Great Decisions, which introduces a groundbreaking technique for overcoming emotional triggers, relieving stress, and making better life choices. Remind us, Helen, what is the drop technique?
The drop is using the brain and neuroscience to signal right away that you are being triggered to feel by holiday, by food, by past memory. And your brain has unique areas that light up physically. Some people grind their teeth. Some people hold their breath. Some people want to get up and move or start talking. That cue that each individual has before cognition ever kicks in and says, oh, you shouldn't eat that, right? That cue is a cue to notice where you're lighting up physically. That shift to notice where stops you from immediately reacting and eating or doing something that might not be great for you. If you notice where you're lighting up and then pause long enough to get back to neutral, where that physical area that lit up goes back to, feeling the chair beneath you, feeling the floor beneath you as you stand, being at neutral, and the physical area that lit up is no longer lit up, that's the cue that the brain is going to spit out words or ideas that it has integrated from all your experience with holiday foods or eating in general. And if you pause with yourself in nanoseconds, the brain spits out words or ideas of what you could do, and you make a decision based on what you hear in yourself, your knowing, and you follow through with that decision. The wonderful thing that happens when you take the time to shift, notice where you're lit up, drop to your head, listen to your brain suggestions, and then make a food choice, is you don't think about it afterwards. You've made the right decision. You're still comfortable. So you walk away enjoying the rest of the time with the cousins or talking about family issues or whatever the family wants to talk about. Instead of being up in your head, second-guessing yourself, saying, I shouldn't have eaten that. I should have eaten that. Oh, my gosh, now I'm going to gain 10 pounds. You have to learn to trust your brain. Once triggered, your brain integrates quickly all of those different components of decision-making, and you will end up walking away satisfied because you made the correct decision.
Is there room for moderation in this technique, Helen? Is there room for, okay, right-sizing portions or right-sizing desserts, or is it kind of an all or nothing choice that really we should be thinking about?
It is a choice made by your brain. Let me give you a great example. If when you have a food in front of you, you go up in your head and go, well, I read this diet book, or this person said to cut portions. Those diet books only work for the people who wrote them, not you. Because those individuals are integrating what their brain knows about food choices and memory and themselves, not you. So the best resource for portion control, if that's what we're talking about, is if you shifted and dropped to the blank screen and your brain suggested eat half of what you did last time, that's the type of portion control we're looking for, something that comes from ourselves, that we hear in ourselves, not an outside source.
Okay, Helen, you emphasize then that empathy plays a role in how we respond to ourselves as we make decisions. Tell me a little more about that and how we need to be self-empathetic with our lives in order to make and guide our decision-making.
That's a wonderful phrase. And it is exactly what the method I'm trying to impart to your readers. Empathy is taking the time when triggered to pause and go through every time you felt that way before, what worked for you, it didn't work for you, until you get back to neutral and then make a decision. So empathy is not giving yourself a hard time about what you ate or didn't eat or what you did in that holiday meeting with family. It is using what worked for you and what didn't work for you to redecide decisions and walk away not second-guessing yourself or not giving yourself a hard time. May I give you an example?
Absolutely. Yeah, you bet.
So if a person grows up and their parents said, you can never have a Twinkie, that child, because everyone else is trying Twinkies at school, for example, or even a holiday gathering, has a dependency of not listening to themselves for the food choices. But every time they make a food choice, oh, mom's voice comes up in their head and says, you can't eat that. That would be a mistake because it would lead to a binge. If we don't listen to ourselves and try things that everyone else does and make decisions based on what our body and brain are telling us, if we don't, those thoughts, those cravings, those situations, I want a Twinkie, keep coming up over and over again. And finally, when the child's alone or when they leave the family home, they binge on the very foods their brains and their memories and their individual personalities were telling them that they wanted. That's a problem.
Dr. McKibben, you reminded us of how important our childhood is in the decisions that we are making today, when we talked about it earlier with food. But it makes me wonder, is that always going to be with us, or can we relearn to become more healthy so it's more like second nature and it's what our brain first thinks about when all of this food is presented to us, or all of these desserts, or the great holiday meals that we come upon during this season?
That's a wonderful statement. And yes, anyone at any age can change the way their brain learn to make decisions growing up. For example, if their thoughts or how they felt or what they wanted to eat wasn't reinforced, oh, I'm going to make you eat the scrambled eggs anyway, right? They shut down listening to themselves and flip into a dependency on reading parent and then as adulthood, everyone else for what to eat, right? This simple method of noticing we're triggered and lighting up, my blood pressure, just went up, is a cue to shift and drop back to neutral and listen to what your brain decides to eat or not eat based on your life experiences and what the brain is having you crave, not someone else. So this simple method of dropping to the blank screen or neutral will allow the individual to rewire their brain with a new configuration on an old neuron track of always being told what to do, for example. Through going back and listening to themselves, and do you know why, Craig, it will work? It's because the brain adapts to what feels better afterwards, not what doesn't. So instead of guilt tripping themselves or, oh, mom's going to be mad at me now, they walk away not thinking about it afterwards because they made a good decision for themselves, and the brain naturally lets them back in reality, enjoying the moment.
And I assume the same absolute philosophy works for people that are concerned that if I go to the mall, I'm going to spend too much, or it's Cyber Absolutely. Monday, I am going to spend too much, but that it's right there in front of me and it's such a good deal. I need to, yep.
And then guess what happens, Chris? They walk away going, why didn't I listen to myself? I knew this was going to happen. So my premise is when you get that physical cue, you shift and drop and listen to yourself before you make that purchase. Because if not, you may walk away going, why didn't I listen to myself? That knowing those words that my brain put together that I'm trying to teach your listeners to listen to, those are the words you always listen to. And that's how you rewire your brain back to satisfaction in life, not reading others.
Dr. Helen McKibben's book is Drop Making Great Decisions. Dr. McKibben, what else are you working on? What should we expect from you in the next year or two?
Well, you selected a nice topic today. I'm actually working on a blog that says, write your own diet book. Because my premise of the brain is you have to use our own brains and experiences for our decisions, whether it's food or anything else. I'm working on a blog, and I'm not writing another book because I'm trying to widen the audience. So people will understand there's a quick, effective method to listen to yourself and rewire your brain to make good choices for yourself.
You can learn more about Dr. Helen McKibben and her book, Drop Making Great Decisions, online at helenmckibben.com. That's HelenMckibben.com. Where she has free resources she'll share with you to show you how to use this revolutionary technique in your daily life. Dr. McKibben, happy holidays. It's wonderful to host you again on Main Street.
Thank you so much for having me.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at starianbank.com.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for December 2nd. Most of us have probably read or heard some version of the Postman's Creed, but according to the U.S. Postal Service, the organization has no official creed or motto. The United States Post Office was founded by the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia on June 26, 1775, at the start of the American Revolution. But it was not until around 1914, when an architectural firm in New York City
popularized the motto when they inscribed the words, "Neither rain, nor snow, nor sleet, nor hail, nor armed villains deterred this hardy courier," on the exterior walls of the New York City Post Office. This version of the creed was derived from the words of the Greek historian Herodotus, who, during the war between the Greeks and the Persians, observed and praised the Persian mounted postal couriers for their bravery. In 1902, about 25 women served as rural mail carriers. By 1904, there were 105 women rural carriers. On this date in 1904, North Dakota newspapers reported on the cool-headed way in which mail carrier Sybil Borland adhered to the swift completion of her appointed rounds. Miss Borland, with a two-horse team, was carrying the mail from Dunseith along her route through the remote woodlands of the Turtle Mountains. At an isolated spot, two men sprang from the bushes alongside the road. With revolvers drawn, they ordered her to stop. Miss Borland did not think this was a sensible idea, and she picked up the pace. Each of the men attempted to catch the horses. One lost his grip, but the other managed to grab onto a horse's bridle. This horse was wild, causing its partner to react wildly as well. The team reared and bolted as the struggle ensued. Miss Borland used her whip on the man holding the horse, striking his face and hands, while the horses increased their speed. The man's clothing got caught in the harness. He tripped and was dragged a considerable distance down the road. When he finally broke free from the team, he was left lying there. Miss Borland did not slow down until she reached the post office. She placed the return mail in the hands of the postmaster and calmly related what had occurred on her route. No clues to the identity of the robbers were ever discovered. The earliest known woman to carry mail on a contract or star route was Mrs. Polly Martin, who did so from about 1860 to 1876. A Boston Daily Globe account of her encounter with highway robbers bears a remarkable similarity to the story told by Miss Borland. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lisa Erdrich. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
This is Bird Note. In North America, the European starling has gained a bad reputation for competing with native bird species for nest cavities. They're not known as good neighbors, to say the least. But to their surprise, researchers at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, saw three hairy woodpecker nestlings receive care from both a female hairy woodpecker and a European starling. A stunning example of a bird caring for another species' young. While the hairy woodpecker fed the chicks more times per hour than the starling, the starling made an effort to clean the nest cavity of waste, which the woodpecker did not do. The researchers aren't certain why the starling began caring for the woodpecker nestlings. Possibly the woodpecker's mate died, and the starling's strong parental instincts led the bird to start bringing food to the unrelated chicks. Begging calls from nestlings seem to work beyond a bird's own species. While one species caring for another is rare among birds, the fact that it does sometimes happen shows just how powerful the sound of a begging chick is to an adult bird. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow on the show, senior paleontologist Clint Boyd of the North Dakota Geological Survey takes us back in time to a remarkable excavation that's happening in northwest North Dakota, the site where mammoth bones were first unearthed during garage construction in 1988 has yielded exciting new discoveries. That's tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us.